Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Next time you think about the tar sands, just think bugs. It's microbes that made crud out of Alberta's crude and gave us the tar sands. With the help of the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, two researchers at the University of Calgary are trying to unlock the secrets of those oil-eating microbes. And for over a decade, the Science Alberta Foundation has been inspiring youngsters and the young at heart into opening their eyes to the wonders of science. Dr. Arlene Ponting epitomizes the enthusiasm which underscores the work of the foundation. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The brave new world of oil production just may rest with some tiny little bacteria that eat oil. So who needs giant refineries and mines at Fort McMurray when one day soon we might simply slip a large bowl into the earth and have those microbes chow down? The scientist working towards this energy revolution is Dr. Stephen Larter. Steve has just moved from Newcastle to the University of Calgary, where he will hold a Canada Research Chair in Petroleum Geology, and he's also a new Alberta Ingenuity Scholar.
Yes, I just moved from the University of Newcastle in the UK, where we had a very large group looking at processes of alteration of crude oil by microorganisms, and so I've moved now with five other members of the group, and Canada is the sort of the world capital of biodegraded oil, really. And so we came here to be, A, in the oil patch and really be where one of the largest accumulations of oil on the planet is that has been formed by microbial alteration of crude oil.
What would that be?
Microbial alteration of crude oil is a set of processes whereby microorganisms, bacteria, and another group of organisms called archaea that kind of look like bacteria, but they're actually physiologically quite different, alter oil and gas in subsurface reservoirs to make materials like heavy oil or the bitumen in the tar sands, and often they also make methane or other byproducts of this process. And most of the world's oil has been altered in this way. So most of the world's oil, is heavy oil, much of it being in Canada and Venezuela.
One of the big problems we have is actually trying to get that stuff out of the ground and being able to get it into a form that can be used. Why do we have so many problems with that?
Well, what the microorganisms do is they consume mainly the hydrocarbons in the oil, and they leave a heavy intractable residue that's acidic, that's very viscous, so it doesn't flow very easily through pipes. And so it's not easy to produce. You've either got to add steam to heat it, basically with steam, to lower the viscosity, make it more fluid and runny, or you've got to mine it, as they do up in Fort McMurray. And so this alteration process takes nice flowing oil and turns it into heavy, viscous crud, basically.
What are you working on that would, help change that or take us into the future?
Well, we've really been doing several different things. Most of our research has been funded to not find heavy oil. It's actually been paid for by major oil companies to understand the processes by which heavy oil is formed so they can avoid finding it in areas like offshore Brazil or the Gulf of Mexico or West Africa. But in the process of trying to understand how this material forms, you understand perhaps potential routes, how these microbial processes could benefit the recovery of heavy oils and even conventional oils in general. And one of the things we've learned that, in fact, one of the major processes is that microorganisms react oil with water, H2O, and one of the major products is methane. They not only make heavy oil, but they also make methane. So one exciting idea is that if the natural process could be accelerated by many thousands of times, whether you can actually recover some of these deposits not as oil but as natural gas. So that's one of the areas where we're kind of looking at.
How would we use that methane or move it around?
Well, obviously methane's much easier to move around in a pipeline. It doesn't really need to be refined. It can just be cleaned up a little bit. But you could just move it in the natural gas pipeline system that I assume, I've only been here 6 weeks, but I assume Canada's got a pretty effective natural gas pipeline system in place already.
How much are we actually recovering at this time of the heavy oil?
Yeah, I believe that that perhaps as little as 7 to 10% of the total heavy oil reserve that's in Alberta, which I believe is, I've seen estimates as high as 3 trillion barrels. So that's, four times the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia, basically. So a colossal amount. But perhaps only 7 to 10% of this can be recovered using the kind of mining and steam, SAGD, as they call it, the steam injection techniques that are currently being used. So a tiny fraction. But the resource is so enormous that even 1% of this resource would be a substantial. I think 1% of the Alberta tar sands is about equivalent to the total recoverable reserves of the North Sea, for example. So even a small difference is a huge, huge amount of oil.
What do you see coming ahead if we move into this area of using microbes more?
Well, I think microorganisms have been used in oil recovery for many, many years. I think the idea of actually using them to produce methane, for example, that's a relatively new idea. And I think it's a very exciting development because not only can it potentially help us recover some of the tar sands and heavy oils, it can also be used to get at that 50% of regular oil, if you like, what we call conventional oil, that's left in most oil reservoirs. So it's estimated that something like 95% of all future oil production will come from already discovered oil fields. And approximately all the oil fields that have already been discovered, we leave half the oil in the ground. So we've got these two enormous targets we can go after. One, the tar sands, colossal amounts of oil, and the other is the half the oil, the conventional oil that's already been discovered that remains in the ground. And microorganisms can potentially recover both these materials. But we're not only looking at microorganisms to try and recover the tar sands. We're also looking at chemical techniques too to try and recover these materials. And I think it's important to remember, in essence, we don't really want oil and gas. We want energy. We want electricity and chemical feedstocks from these reservoirs. And if we can actually leave much of the carbon in the reservoir, then obviously that has environmental benefits too. So we're working together with colleagues in geophysics, chemical engineering, and other parts of the university to look at a sort of next generation set of techniques beyond the mining and the steam flooding that potentially can recover some of Alberta's energy in a much more environmentally friendly and feasible manner.
What might some of those methods be? Like, will we always be tied to having to take the stuff out of the ground and then produce it or refine it, or are there other ways?
Well, I think ideally, of course, the ideal thing we'd like to do is to build, if you like, a refinery in the ground and what we call sort of in situ recovery, where we do the upgrading, we do all the messy stuff in the ground, we leave as much of the carbon in the ground as we can and recover high-value products like natural gas and very light oils directly from the reservoir. So we're looking at schemes where we build effectively big pots in the reservoir, where we inject catalysts, where we use geophysics and other techniques to monitor the reactions that are going on in place. Essentially a sort of in situ refinery, really, a refinery in a reservoir.
How far in the future do you think we would see some of this stuff being put into practice?
Well, I think it's quite likely within the next 5 years we could see some of the early stages where already in the department here people are using geophysics, for example, to monitor heavy oil recovery. Already we're using geochemistry to understand where the best parts of the heavy oil fields are to produce. So we're already on the start of this curve, and I think very quickly, within 5 years, I would hope there would be some impact on, if you like, the types of production that are occurring now, the steam flooding operations and so-called coal production. I think that could be impacted within 5 years. I think these biological recovery, in situ reactor types of things, you're looking probably a decade away, something like that. But I think it'll happen quite quickly. And of course, with the oil price high, in the $40 a barrel, and I think unlikely to come down now, suddenly there's going to be a huge impetus, I think, from the oil industry to actually invest in these next generation, develop these next generation technologies to try and recover this huge resource. I'm fairly optimistic that within my kind of career lifetime, if you like, we'll see some of these some of our work having some impact on this these new types of processes.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Stephen Larter. He holds a Canada Research Chair in Petroleum Geology at the University of Calgary. He's also a new Alberta Ingenuity Scholar, and he's one of the researchers involved in the Institute for Sustainable Energy, Environment and Economy at the University of Calgary. One of the researchers helping Dr. Stephen Larter is Jennifer Adams. Named as one of Canada's top 25 young bright minds by Maclean's magazine, Jennifer is a PhD student in geology and geophysics at the University of Calgary. Jennifer will be working on computer simulations to unlock the secrets of the microbes that turn oil into tar, and that's thanks to a studentship award from Alberta Ingenuity.
That was given to me primarily to look at biodegradation of petroleum in deep subsurface reservoirs. So looking at how microbes who live deep in the rock actually digest petroleum that comes into reservoirs. And these microbes, through the process of biodegradation, reduce the oil from a nice, light, sweet crude to an oil which becomes heavy and sulfur-rich, and therefore it's expensive to refine, and it's also difficult to extract. So we're looking at how these microbes take a very valuable oil product and make it into something that looks a lot like the Athabasca tar sands.
What kind of microbes are these?
They're actually anaerobic bacteria, and so that means they exist in an environment where there's no oxygen. So it's not like a piece of fruit rotting in your fridge. There's no oxygen, and so anaerobes often use water or even sulfate or other metals that are in water to oxidize hydrocarbons. And the thing about anaerobes is that an anaerobic process is much slower than an aerobic system. So this happens over the course of millions of years.
How did they even get down that deep in the ground and live for so long?
They actually were buried there. So they started on the seafloor, living happily, and sediment piled on top of them, and they just got stuck in the pores and survived the process of lithification or the formation of rock, and they live there. We don't have much evidence to show that they move. Much of the work that my supervisor has done has shown that if you take a rock that contains these microbes deep into the earth past a temperature of 80 or 90 degrees Celsius, you actually pasteurize the rock just like your milk. So you cook your milk and all the microbes die. Same thing with the rock. Once you've heated it up too hot, they die, and then if you bring the rock back up to cooler temperatures, no biodegradation occurs because the microbes have died and none move into that reservoir.
So with the work that you're doing, how do you actually deal with these microbes?
Most of my work is numerical simulation. So I use a computer. We use a reservoir simulator, so it's a model that simulates fluid flow, heat flow of oil, water, and gas. And what we do is we actually put the microorganisms into the model at more or less the oil-water contact, and then they're told to digest at a certain rate using certain chemical formulas the petroleum that they find adjacent to them.
What have you found out so far?
Well, things are still fairly preliminary. What we do is we run these simulations and try and replicate the actual geochemical data that's been collected primarily in some of the Chinese reservoirs, which are huge heavy oil provinces, and they have really great compositional gradients. So basically you can see that the microbes have been eating away at the bottom of the oil column, and you get these gradients of of more digested oil at the bottom and less digested at the top. But you asked what we'd found out. What we're doing is we're watching what happens to the gas that's generated by the microbes. So the microbes take a liquid oil, they digest it, and basically generate CO2 and methane, which in some conditions in the subsurface is gas. So does the gas bubble up to the top? Does it scoot out sideways out of the reservoir? Where does it go? And we're still working some of that out. It does both in our simulations.
Well, is there an attempt to try and stop or reverse the process of it going from sweet petroleum into something ooky?
Well, they can use some of this work to look at the enhancement of production of heavy oils. So that's one application. I don't think they'll be stopping the biodegradation that's occurring. It happens so slowly that it would be hard for us to know that it was happening on over our timescale. What's important about the work we're hoping to get done is that we might be able to understand the key components that control the biodegradation. And once we've done that, we might be able to predict where you might find a less biodegraded oil versus a more biodegraded oil, and direct oil companies to try and explore in the zones where you'd find a sweeter, lighter crude rather than the heavy, ucky stuff.
Are there other people working on this around the world? Is it a big race?
No, it's not quite as big as CO2 disposal. That's a rat fight. Yeah. Anyways, there are a collection of people that our group collaborates with. People in Norway. There's a big group in Newcastle, of course, where Dr. Larder has just moved from. It's a hot topic for the industry, but it doesn't seem to be a big deal in the science world. Not everyone's racing to do that. What is interesting is that the earth scientists and geologists are really collaborating with the microbiologists who have always sort of lived in a lab, and now we're trying to culture these bugs that live at these hot temperatures, 70, 80 degrees, maybe 2 or 3 kilometers down. So it's an exciting time because it's really very cross-disciplinary. And we learn lots from the microbiologists, and they get to go to parts of the world they never thought of.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
That was Jennifer Adams, a PhD student in geology and geophysics at the University of Calgary, and she's a recipient of an Alberta Ingenuity studentship. At some point in their careers, just about every young science student in Alberta has played with the materials tucked inside a big black box called Science in a Crate. These crates are just one of the many programs developed by the engaging and creative minds at the Science Alberta Foundation. Dr. Arlene Ponting is the foundation's chief executive officer.
Yes, the Science Alberta Foundation is a not-for-profit organization, and we champion learning and developing an enthusiasm for science and math and technology. And we do that in communities and schools throughout the province, from Fort Chippewa down to Medicine Hat. In fact, last year we were in 150 communities in Alberta. And now with our programs on the internet, we have boundless reach. So we're very proud of our model of reaching out across the province and bringing programs to Albertans wherever they live.
How did the foundation get started?
It's really an interesting story. Science Alberta Foundation was formed by concerned citizens all across the province. And they were concerned about Alberta's ability to compete in the global economy. And this was 14 years ago. They felt that we needed to have youth that were interested in science and choosing careers that are science and technology intensive. They felt we needed to have a population that could think about science in a critical way. And they felt it was very, very important for Albertans to understand how science affects our everyday lives and that it's very, very important for our prosperity. And this was 14 years ago, as I say, but yet those reasons are even more important now.
What is it that got you interested in working for the Science Alberta Foundation?
Good question. My background is science. My first degree is pharmacy, so I have a real love of science to begin with. And then I went on to do a PhD in education. And therefore, this job is just a melding of both those, because we have a very strong focus, obviously, on science. But what we're about is communicating science, which is really helping individuals learn and appreciate science. And when I mean learn, I mean both in formal and informal contexts, so that we're learning throughout our lives, but we're also learning in schools and in universities as well.
What do you think it is that kind of puts people off from science, that we're not so comfortable with it or literate in science?
That's a good question, and it's really true. And I believe that most of us think that science happens in laboratories or it exists in textbooks. I don't think we really appreciate that science touches our everyday lives. It influences what we eat. It influences our travel, how we communicate. Who would have thought you would have had a website like you do and communicate in the way you do? So it's that relevance that's very, very important. And that's a very strong focus of our programming, is to make the science relevant. And we do that even better by situating it in an Alberta context. So we kind of spark that curiosity and that wonder, which is really important in terms of embracing science and feeling it's worthwhile and a safe thing to learn and do.
You're focusing a lot on the younger generation, and your work comes out through the schools. What are some of the programs that you have available?
Mm-hmm. Well, we do both. We have wonderful programs in the community, and we also have programs in the schools. Particularly, our strong program in the schools is our Science in a Crate program. And it's not just for schools, though. We also send crates to libraries, to interpretive centers. We have created a crate for guides and scouts so that the leaders can bring science to life for 3 meetings and help them get their science badge. We have crates that go into communities where there are organizations running camps, summer camps, spring break camps, and we provide just fun, enticing, but very, very good learning activities to bring that camp to life, because we want students or campers in Grand Prairie to have the same opportunities they do in the big cities. The crate topics are quite unique, and we do use storylines and comics and role-playing and mysteries. Mysteries are a great way to learn sort of that scientific inquiry process, because you're kind of figuring out the mystery and looking for the evidence and having a hypothesis. So it's those very unique strategies that engage those young minds.
One of the other things you have is this really wonderful website called Wonderville. Tell me about Wonderville.
Oh, I'd love to. And that really is where my world is really from a previous life. Wonderville is this virtual town with these zany characters. And what we wanted to do was to really make science engaging on the internet. And in order for good learning to happen, we knew we needed to have that human touch. And therefore, we developed these zany characters that children really relate to, but not just children. It's the child in all of us. Although our target is predominantly ages 7 to 12, we have people on the site from 7 to 87. And the interesting thing, Cheryl, is how long people actually stay when they come to Wonderville. Over 50% of the visitors to Wonderville stay there for over 30 minutes. That's quite amazing in this medium that is really often click, read, and go. So we've got it right. And this rich, rich medium of sound and video lends itself so well to science.
What other things do you have on the go?
I really want to tell you about our science festivals. Science festivals are quite a fascinating concept. We're the only ones in Canada that organize science festivals. We know of science festivals in Edinburgh. We know of some in Belgium. But here in Alberta, we have science festivals. We've organized 11 of them. And our next festival that's coming up is our festival in the Wood Buffalo Municipality, focused predominantly in Fort McMurray, but certainly reaching out to communities around. One of the things that we're really wanting to do is to get young adults more engaged in science. And we're having a science cafe up at Fort McMurray. And here, too, part of what Science Alberta Foundation is sort of scan the world to see what's happening. This is big in the United Kingdom, big in France. And what it is young adults come to a cafe. We have a science expert talk about a topic, often an edgy topic, because you want it to be kind of controversial or stimulate. And then they sit around and talk about what they've learned and what they think about it and debate and dialogue. So we're going to have a science cafe up in Fort McMurray. We're looking forward to that. And when we have science festivals, we can really show cool science jobs. Wonderville is a great way we do that, too. On that site, we've got Science at Work, where we have sort of short, hip, rock videos that show Albertans doing interesting work. For instance, the Gas Control Center for TransCanada is like a mini NASA. So we went in there and talked to all the gas controllers about their work, and they are cool science jobs. And there's cool science jobs in all kinds of fields that we wouldn't think. One tour we went on, which was kind of fun when we were in Lethbridge, was the tattoo parlor.
The tattoo parlor. What happened at the tattoo parlor?
Well, we just simply took youth in to sort of see, now what do you think the science is around tattoos? Well, we sure know that the needles need to be sterile, but what about that dye? I mean, why does it stay there? Why does it not wear away? Why does the bloodstream not absorb it? Is it safe? What's it made of? So that's just an example of intriguing questions in absolutely every job that is possible to think of.
How do you know that these programs are being effective, that people really are learning about science from them?
That's a very, very important thing for us, because we need to know we're having an impact. We do that need to have that information for many reasons. One, to help us improve what we do so we get better at it. But two, we have to show to our donors and sponsors and the government that we're really, really putting their money to good use and producing outcomes. So we did embark on a very sophisticated evaluation system. We hired experts to work with us, and we evaluate our programs very, very rigorously. We get at attitudes to science and technology, if we're changing that. We get at those learning outcomes, and we do that through various evaluation methods.
Thank you very much, Arlene.
It's been my pleasure.
That was Dr. Arlene Ponting, Chief Executive Officer for the Science Alberta Foundation. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Science Alberta Foundation, Alberta Ingenuity, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Ducks Unlimited Canada, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.